All right. So my discussion is going to be around reorganizing care, primarily for the uninsured. Now, my background prior to joining this group, I've been at Regional One about a year and a half, and before that I was at Children's. And we had uninsured children, and for the most part, uninsured children get what? Right, they get some kind of insurance coverage, that sort of thing. So this has been a huge wake-up call for me in terms of the amount of uninsured that our organization sees and the challenges that that entails. So that's kind of where my discussion is going. These were the key contributors. I have somebody here, Dr. Walter Jones. He's back in the corner. Everybody wave. He helped me pull this together. A little bit of the marketing slide. Who are we? We're in Memphis. We're growing. We're becoming more and more of a system. Our primary hospital is in downtown Memphis. It's a 620-plus bed hospital, and it is redefining itself. We are redefining ourselves. So this is sort of the marketing piece of that. I'm not going to go through all of it. And I know I have limited time. So this is our mission, to improve the health and well-being of the people that we serve, providing compassionate care and exceptional services. This is our mission in collaboration with our academic partners. We'll be the premier healthcare system advancing the quality of life in our communities. Our prior name was The Med. Anybody familiar with The Med in Memphis? Oh, yeah, I got a couple. You okay? So we're trying to reinvent ourselves. We're a huge trauma hospital. We see a lot of uninsured and this sort of thing. And we're growing new service lines, new business lines, that sort of thing. And I've got the majority of those new business lines. They report up through me. We've gone through this huge rebranding, and that's why I'm giving you some of these marketing slides. And our new name is Regional One Health. What's in a name? Another marketing piece. But you can see we're sort of changing our image. We've got the more current font. This is important, apparently, in the marketing world. This is our background here. You know, we've been around since 1829. We are the oldest hospital in the city, okay? I mean, we've got buildings that you wouldn't believe how old they are, you know, and I'm used to a lot more newer, more state-of-the-art facilities. So, again, that's been a challenge. But you can kind of see where we're going. We've got some tremendous service lines, which we'll talk about in a bit. We've got 483 physicians. We've got 2,000 almost 2,500 employees. You can kind of see the stats here. We were recently named one of the best workplaces. Our NICU is a state-of-the-art NICU. We have really changed the mortality rate in our city, which did not look very good there for a while, in partnering with the Children's Hospital. So you can kind of see our stats. So this is kind of the crux of it. We are 28.6% self-pay. I mean, that's huge. You guys, okay. And I'm in a state that's not expanding Medicaid. Now, I'm actually talking about that tomorrow, if you guys want to come see me. This conversation isn't as much around the Medicaid piece, but this is a tremendous amount of self-pay. So what we've run into is, or what I've learned, is nobody else really wanted to step up to the plate and help the uninsured. Okay, we've got behavioral health issues, we've got continuity of care issues, and trying to get the community to come together to help to move them into the right next level of care has been completely challenging. So this particular effort was around the length of stay. Now, is having a lower length of stay good or bad? Right. So it can be too low, it can be too high. Right? It's kind of like the Goldilocks theory. You want it to be just right, right? But statistically, when you looked at us compared to similar organizations, in general, our length of stay was very, very high, comparatively, adjusted for all the right things, okay? So we recognized that. And the other one, part of the issue was is that we couldn't move the patients who were uninsured, right? Because we couldn't get them to the next level of care. So that's what this talks about. We had a project. It was a very Six Sigma oriented type of effort, and so the plan was to move our length of stay in our medicine services down by 0.5 by 2013. So, you know, you guys have all seen this before. Define, measure, and I'm not going to go through all this, but basically we had the focus on medicine because it was an area that we could control. We also focused on trauma services, but the data in this particular presentation is around. We focused on the inpatient service. We actually broke it down by the inpatient service, the number of admissions, discharges, and again, the payer source, which is what this particular conversation is about. So we went through the voice of the customer. You guys have probably all seen this before. You know, how available are the services, discharge planning, DME. And I'll tell you, when we were first looking at this, we really weren't thinking about it from a payer source perspective. We were just looking at all of the barriers and the obstacles that we were running into. You know, non-compliant patients, patient goals, could we get the DME? So what we ran into, these were the driving issues, care coordination. And when we looked into the care coordination piece, it was very heavily around our uninsured population. Okay, the availability of services, that's more, you know, is radiology available when you need them? Did the lab come and get the specimen to get them discharged, that kind of stuff? And then the physician availability. How long were we waiting for physicians to come and give that consult in order to move forward or to have the surgery for the patient? And then the idea was to decrease the length of stay. This is the way we would report how we were doing. We were either green, yellow, red. You guys know what that means. These are some of the efforts that we went through. We changed our computer system slightly. We looked at our historical data. You can see we're all over the place for those of you who like slides like this. We were having a hard time getting any kind of stability and to reduce variation in our length of stay. We had a multidisciplinary team, et cetera, et cetera. So we measured against the GLOS, the standard. We were out of whack, even after we adjusted for everything. We brought in a hospitalist service to better manage these patients. Okay, so we actually brought them on. There were actually a lot of physicians we already worked with. We just tooled them together and created a management structure that could create more accountability. And they are a great group of doctors. Multidisciplinary rounds, there was more collaboration. We had a new process for prioritizing discharge orders so we can get in front of them earlier. Even making sure that we were writing the orders by a specific time during the day so everybody could react to it. Tracking the care delays. Initially it was very difficult to even see, when did we put that consult in? You know, did they write it? Did they put it in the CPOE system? You know, even trying to track that was very complicated. We streamlined much of that. We did the Plan G Check Act that you guys are all very much aware of, and then we had these things called snap huddles where everybody would come together and talk about what we were going to do with each patient. But the self-pay piece really focused around what I have in the circle. The behavioral health issues, we do not have a behavioral health unit. And so trying to place patients was very, very complicated. A SNF really wouldn't take our patients. LTAC, if they needed a higher level of care, again, we couldn't place them. They were staying in our ICU. What would happen is we would have patients stay ridiculous amounts of time trying to negotiate where these patients were going to go downstream. And the other piece that was happening is that we were going on diversion in our emergency department because we couldn't move the patients out of the beds to get patients in that were coming in, many times with coverage. And then rehab was another issue, trying to get them into rehab. So this kind of shows you what it looked like. What we found in this 40%, most of the patients that were having trouble, the longer ones were more your self-pay patients. And then this is past the average days, the effective days. Was really, you know, within a day or two that we could focus on. If we could just get that 1 or 2 days, we might be able to really move the needle and then focus on that very large self-pay group to get us going. This kind of tells you where we were. See the medicine ones there, A, B, C, and D, that's where we targeted in this particular paper. Trauma is another one we're looking at, and it's looking really good, but that's not this paper. It's a future paper. Maybe. We'll see. So you can kind of see we did the whole cause and effect diagram. We broke down all the different reasons why things were happening, tried to get to the root cause. We found the discharge planning to be a problem, the availability, and that goes back to what I said earlier. And the discharge planning really did link back many times to our uninsured population. This was the original detailed process flow. This isn't meant for you to read. And then you can see it gets simpler. That's the point. See? It's very busy. It gets simpler. All right, so the self-pay. So what did we do? We actually had to go out into the community and negotiate rates and pay the community, SNFs, nursing, whatever we could, to get these folks where they needed to be, which would cost less than if they stayed in the acute care side. Does that make sense? So trying to get them home health, trying to get them what they need, behavioral health. We actually had to have create some contracts with some behavioral health partners to try to figure out how we would handle this, and they're only willing to, you know, take X number of self-pays, and then after that we have to pay, and we don't know how many we're going to get. I mean, we can look at trends and this sort of thing. So, but it was more important for us to make sure these folks got what they needed, and understand, too, that we're not expanding Medicaid. So this problem doesn't get solved in our current situation, and we are in a world of hurt because our governor and I don't want to get too much into the politics, but they basically have made it unconstitutional, seriously, in the state of Tennessee, to accept any federal dollars that are linked to the ACA. Unconstitutional, I'm not kidding. But we've just re-elected this same governor, and we're hopeful now that he's re-elected he'll think about this a little differently. So we'll talk about that tomorrow. And then we actually created an LTAC where we could move some of these patients ourselves to get them out. So we've actually got 24-bed LTAC that's doing quite well. Rehab, we expanded our rehab program from 20 beds to 30 beds. Now they're like, they're actually single rooms, and they're quite nice. In fact, we have some of our self-pay folks enjoying them so much, they say it's like a spa, and they don't want to go home. So, and then planning for SNP, we're actually looking at, and I know people are like, oh my gosh, you don't want to, you know, do that. You're going to have Medicare or all the auditors pull it up the driveway and they won't leave you, right? Because there's so many regulations when you put in a SNP. Hello. That was sort of funny. So we're actually looking at that. We've gone through the CON board, and we're actually going to take the old rehab space and create a SNP, so that we can move our own patients. And yes, we understand that that takes some risk on, but if we don't have the ability to move like we need to, we can't get other patients in that help to offset the ability to pay for self-pay or uninsured patients, especially looking into this future that we're looking at in the state of Tennessee. There's that nice shorter flow. So you can kind of see what's been happening. It's a definitely negative trend line. It is statistically significant. And you guys seen these statistics, you know, obviously these bars don't overlap. So you can see there's actually been improvement. This was the control chart at the end of our project. But actually, this is the more recent data. So even after all the work that we've already done, you can see that that was the one that you just saw. And even since then, which was since we sent out the abstract for this meeting, we've made more improvement. You're seeing, you guys know this, I'm sure, but as the upper and lower control limits get closer together, what does that mean?
You're reducing gradients, right?
So it's becoming a more stable process, right? So we're excited about these results. You know, more to come on that, but that's the crux of my project. And then there was some financial impact. This is based on, and I'm not going to go through this whole thing, but it's based on the bed turn. So the availability of the bed is how we're looking at this. So every time that there's a bed that's taken up that could be used by someone who can pay, you know, so that's kind of where this math comes in. But anyway, it's about $1.6 million. So it's not chump change, and, you know, granted it's $50 million we'll be losing if we don't expand Medicaid and they reduce our dish dollars. But, you know, hey, you know, it's a start. So anyway, there's a significant amount of difficulty in placing self-pay uninsured patients. We're looking at a fairly significant dish dollar decrease in $12 million, probably is what we're looking at for 2016, and it's not looking too promising right now. The care of the poor is important. We need to take care of the poor. So what we're trying to do is reduce any waste, look for areas where we can be more efficient, try to make improvements to offset some of this while we work through the political environment to try to get either continued dish dollars, and maybe they'll feel sorry for us, write your congressman, or possibly an expansion of Medicaid. We are kind of looking at the Arkansas model. I hear that our governor might be somewhat open to that discussion, so we'll see how it pans out. We're a little worried. And then you can build your own infrastructure if you can't get your community first to fully engage, you know, and so we have invested in a couple programs and things. Some of the spaces that we had recently moved out of to create more capacity. So, I guess, I think that, no, oh, I have slides. Okay, so. So this is our new rehab room, a little bit more marketing. It's actually quite lovely. This is our new outpatient surgery center that we recently pulled together. And this is a new OR. And do you guys have any questions? I guess questions for the panel as well.
Okay, we've had three wonderful presentations, and at this time we'll open the floor up for questions for any of our panelists.
The children's hospital I worked at was right across the street from where I'm working. I literally walked 50 feet from my old parking spot to my new parking spot. And I don't think I fully appreciated how much uninsured was being seen at the regional medical center. So I think that overall, and sort of the wow, and how do we survive? How does this work? You know, and the dependency on the government subsidies and trying to think that through. Now, we have had some impact on the exchanges, so we've got a few more folks signing up for that, but the people we see are literally in that donut hole. And the presentation I have tomorrow shows exactly how many we're talking about that are in that donut hole that can't get coverage.
Now, one of the fears was that, one of the fears of the ACA was that employer-sponsored insurance would go down.
So much. We have seen changing of hours. We were talking about this where people, apparently the ACA took full time from 32 to 30. And so I guess that's an impact that we've definitely seen. But in terms of them opting out and having their whole, you know, employee rank start to use the Obamacare network. We had a question back.
Yeah, my question for Bruce. Certainly there are frustrations looking at the reported attitudes and the actual behaviors, but I'm a little bit more interested in the pessimistic views that you looked at, and I'm wondering if you looked at that with any more granularity in terms of the type of provider or services they were on, the type of facility they were in, the organizational structure, the management structure, and how that might have affected the different prevalences of those.
Well, the design of our project doesn't allow that. We only had roughly 37 respondents for each hospital, spread between the three professions, social work, nurses, medical residents. So what we were really studying were 295 health professionals spread between eight hospitals. So we didn't have enough, a large enough sample at any particular hospital to generalize about the hospitals themselves. But I'd love to do that in future research to try to figure out if you really expanded patient advocacy and policy advocacy among these health professionals and had a large sample in a number of hospitals, so you could actually see what effects it might have on the hospital itself if you really amped this up in some of those hospitals. But we couldn't do that. We only had 37 respondents in each hospital. So we couldn't generalize to the hospitals themselves. We could to the 295 health professionals, but not the hospitals.
Did all of your hospitals have residency programs?
They all did.
It seemed like the number of social workers might have been overrepresented. That seemed, I think it's like almost a third of your...
It was a third of each profession. One-third, that's what for Corey's mind. One-third social workers, one-third nurses, one-third medical residents. Because we regard all of those three professions as part of the frontline health professional core. And it's true, there are fewer social workers per hospital, obviously, than there are nurses or medical residents. We actually had to oversample in one hospital to get our sample, because many hospitals have only 5, 6, 10 social workers.
I have a question now as well. I was looking at the demographics, your racial and ethnic demographics in your presentation, and is that representative of the area that you were in? Because it seems
Los Angeles.
It seems like you had a very high number of Asian Americans, and the sample of African Americans was low. Hispanics looked about right. I think you had 13%. That looked like about what you would find in the U.S.
Well, we have a huge Asian population in Los Angeles. Huge. Like 1 million people of Taiwanese descent in one particular part of L.A. I mean, it's the largest
so
Asian.
So is it your largest ethnic group? Is that what you would say?
No, but many of them do gravitate into the health field. But you're right, relatively few African Americans, which is horrible. And actually, the Latino group is not representative of the sheer number of Latinos in L.A.
Mm-hmm. It's larger than 13%?
Oh, way larger.
Okay.
Yeah, no. 40%. I mean, it's just huge.
Okay.
So, we're probably the most diverse city, one historian says, maybe this is overstating the world history. but you're right, there's underrepresentation of key groups in the health enterprise. It's a very good point.
But it is representative of what you would find in the health professions in LA.
Yeah.
Do we have any additional questions from the audience? Okay, let's thank our presenters.